Blog Talk Radio.
We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
I accept this award today with an abiding faith in America, an audacious faith in the future of mankind. I refuse to accept the idea that man is mere flotsam and jetsam in the river of life, unable to influence the unfolding events which surround him. I refuse to accept the view that mankind is so tragically bound to the starless midnight of racism and war, that the bright daybreak of peace and brotherhood can never become a reality. I have the audacity to believe that peoples everywhere can have 3 meals a day for their bodies, education and culture for their minds, and dignity, equality, and freedom for their spirits. Your Majesty, Your Royal Highness, Mr. President, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, I accept the Nobel Prize for Peace at a moment when 22 million Negroes of the United States are engaged in a creative battle to end the long night of racial injustice. I accept this award on behalf of the civil rights movement, which is moving with determination and a majestic scorn for risk and danger to establish a reign of freedom and a rule of justice. I am mindful that only yesterday in Birmingham, Alabama, our children crying out for brotherhood were answered with fire hoses, snarling dogs, and even death.
you know, that's all the thing we can do.
I am mindful that only yesterday in Philadelphia, Mississippi, young people seeking to secure the right to vote were brutalized and murdered. I am mindful that debilitating and grinding poverty afflicts my people and chains them to the lowest rung of the economic ladder. Therefore, I must ask why this prize is awarded to a movement which is beleaguered and committed to unrelenting struggle, to a movement which has not yet won the very peace and brotherhood which is the essence of the Nobel Prize. After contemplation, I conclude that this award which I receive on behalf of that movement is a profound recognition that nonviolence is the answer to the crucial political and moral questions of our time. The need for man to overcome oppression and violence without resorting to violence and oppression. Civilization and violence are antithetical concepts. Negroes of the United States, following the people of India, have demonstrated that nonviolence is not sterile passivity, but a powerful moral force which makes for social transformation. Sooner or later, all the peoples of the world will have to discover a way to live together in peace and thereby transform this pending cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of brotherhood. If this is to be achieved, man must evolve for all human conflict a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love. The torturous road which has led from Montgomery, Alabama to Oslo bears witness to this truth. This is a road over which millions of Negroes are traveling to find a new sense of dignity. This same road has opened for all Americans a new era of progress and hope. It has led to a new civil rights bill, and it will, I am convinced, be widened and lengthened into a superhighway of justice as Negro and white men in increasing numbers create alliances to overcome their common problems. I refuse to accept despair as the final response to the ambiguities of history. I refuse to accept the idea that the isness of man's present nature makes him morally incapable of reaching up for the eternal oughtness that forever confronts him. I refuse to accept the cynical notion that nation after nation must spiral down a militaristic stairway into the hell of nuclear annihilation. I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. This is why right temporarily defeated is stronger than evil triumphant. I believe that even amid today's mortar bursts and whining bullets, there is still hope for a brighter tomorrow. I believe that wounded justice lying prostrate on the blood-flowing streets of our nations, can be lifted from this dust of shame to reign supreme among the children of men.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro has still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this...
Hey, this I'm going to say it again. When you get ready to understand so much that's going on in America, you got to deal with the racism. You got to deal with the white supremacy and racism that's going on in America. Dr. King said it 10 years ago, and it's still the same thing today. We're still going through the kind of racial stuff that's happening here in Chicago, Detroit, around America. And right now, I want to deal this evening with Martin Luther King Jr. movement as a movement to feed the hunger, the movement to close the naked, movement to see about people that's depressed and people that's locked up in jail as political prisoners. Now, we know the press play a big part of PR. They have the police put people in jail. We know some police, they lie, they got rogue police. That role of people that the DA role, that role judges. What I mean by that, they do things, they sit down and put innocent people in jail, whether you like it or not. And you have to understand that. I want to take my time to tonight to talk about the racism and the white supremacy that go on in America that we see every day that's going on in your neighborhood, on your job, in your church, in your civic organization. When you said Martin Luther King, when you said Malcolm X, Paul Martha, Dunbar, Robeson, you're talking about black leaders that was standing for truth and justice in the American way. And one thing you have to realize, and I hope you realize that, that from the get-go, when they brought us over here, it wasn't for no justice for us. We were brought over to work in the cotton field, corn field, sugar cane field, tobacco field, because the black man made America rich. And we didn't get out of 40 acres of the mule. We didn't get reparations. I know some of you said, well, don't say that. If you owe me, pay me what you owe me. You owe my ancestors, so they did. It falls to me and you. So if America was to pay reparations, every black man in America could start their own business and be successful. You want to know how come white folks are successful? White folks got a help from the government. You want to know how come the Arab got, they got a help, they got tax write-off. But the black man didn't get no tax write-off. We didn't get nothing but jail and hell. So what I'm telling you, some of this stuff kept us locked in. And as today, because of what's happened to us today, you might think it that you're free. You're not free. Because when you look at the crime, you look at the economic situation. You know, when you look at who got all the money, who got all the yachts, who got all the buildings. You've been working, your great-granddad has been working, but they have come in and the government gave them land. Government gave them free schools.
We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. Then I go to my brother, and I say, brother, help me please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. But I know a change gon' come. Oh, yes it will.
I wanna say there's a change coming, and that was Sam Cooke before his time. King before his time, Malcolm before his time, telling the truth. Now they've been trying to stop the guns. If several policemen got killed, they're going to stop these guns from falling. When the citizens get killed, they don't stop them. Now they're checking where the guns come from. How come they didn't check the guns with all these other black people being shot on the expressway, being shot? But I had prophesied a year ago that when you bring pain, pain gonna circle and come back. You ain't heard the last of it yet. I don't want to bear bad news, but the wages of sin is death, and the gift of God is eternal life. Innocent people got to die for some of the innocent gonna die for the righteous when they open up. And what I'm saying if you can stop police from getting killed, you stop Joe Blow from getting killed on the streets, breaking in houses, and it ain't concerning. People is tired of being murdered in the streets, love running down the streets, and the politicians don't do nothing about it. Now, I'm telling you, these politicians got to get on board. These aldermen and governors that's playing, these people are not playing. It's a gun. You can get a gun quick and you can go to McDonald's and get a hamburger. So if they don't do something, we are bound for chaos in America. Black on black, white on white, whatever. And I'm going to say this. When black folks started shooting white folks, they're going to stop it right away. As long as black on black get killed, ain't nothing happening. As long as somebody in your neighborhood, your color getting killed. But when it change over and go to that other race, they're going to find how to stop it. The Congress, the Democrats, the Republicans, they're going to do it. And I'm going to say, the Republicans and some of these Republicans, they've been playing out of Hitler playbook. And Hitler playbook is murder, murder, murder. When you turn the cover on Hitler playbook, 6 million Jews were killed. You turn another page, he had 1,000 people he operated on to try to make a super a white man. Trump did this. And then you turn another page, Trump sent bombs to bomb people. You know, when you talk about the nuclear bomb, that's out of Trump playbook. Okay, who did it? They're getting it from Trump playbook. The Democrats are being quiet, but some of them is undercover Republicans. All the Republicans is working out of Trump. Trump is working out of Hitler playbook, and all the Republicans is working out of Hitler playbook. Let me tell you why. Trump want to stop the right to vote. That's Hitler playbook. Hitler killed 6 million Jews. First he took them, put them in a cage, put them in the oven, and cooked them. You ain't got to trust me. Read
Hitler what he did, had he had scientists, the poison people. He had scientists to cut people's genitals out and trying to, like you're talking about, I'm trans, the homosexual. Trump was cutting penises out and cutting wounds out and placing them and sewing them on men and sewing penises on women. This was his scientists. This is Hitler playbook. We are living right now in the Hitler playbook. Murder on top of murder. Then he had the pharmaceutical company sending pills out. You know they can cure cancer. They can cure high blood. They can do all that. But some pharmaceutical companies is working out of Hitler playbook. Pause and kill them. Keep giving them medicine. Oh, y'all ain't liking me tonight. Now, this is what's going on right now. And what I'm saying, and if you begin to do some reading, you see how many people Hitler cut open, took their liver, their lungs, and put, trying to make a superhuman being. And he had scientists, and some of them were Jews. Some of the Jews were with Hitler. Some of the car companies sold Hitler cars and tanks. Y'all would hear what I'm saying. Hitler playbook is still real. Trump got it, and all the Republicans got it. If you don't believe it, they said, don't wear no mask. Don't take no pills. That's mass murder. This is what happened. And when Europeans came over from Europe, the Congress gave them money. Congress gave them land. Some of this land that's flooding out right now, land that was given up with black folks, some of these lands that's burning and flooding, that land supposed to went to your ancestors and my ancestors, but they didn't give it to them. They gave it to Europeans.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists.
Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor.
The promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burden both at the front and at home.
The other thing I want you to understand is this, that it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counts. It didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yes.
All labor has dignity.
Yes.
But you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages. America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And the question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will.
At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check. I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. As somebody said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure, high, and clean. But I want to get the language right tonight. I want to get the language so right that everybody here will cry out, yes, I'm black, I'm proud of it, I'm black and beautiful.
What is the relationship between this and the reality of the Negro masses?
King taught us women to love ourselves, proud, black power. You know, Chicago is the only city in America that you got a black mayor, you got a black state's attorney, and you got a black, and then you got a black to run the county. So Chicago really black power, and people don't know it. But what I'm saying to you, Dr. King was saying, you can't write a bill to make people love you. You can't write a bill, created goodwill that we love each other. And we got to begin to love each other and stop loving other people. Look in the mirror and see yourself. You know, I just want to say that your business can grow, but you have to be able to open the business up. Other people come in the neighborhood in the morning, they leave out with all the money, they don't come back till 6 o'clock. We have to be able to control our community. We have to be able to control our churches, our business. Ain't nothing popping in the black community but a funeral home. Why? Because we allow that. And once we make our mind up to stop the killing, it can stop. Long, strong black women, strong black men can stand up. Because my prophecy is, as we go back to school, Kim, you're going to see so many kids, 12 and 13, got guns. So not only the virus you're going to run from, you can run from the kids got guns shooting at other kids. When I was going to school, we had a flame shot. That's what we had, a flame shot. You did good. If you did good, you got a BB gun. But now these people got, these young folks got 357 Magnum. They got machine guns. These 12 and 13 and 14 year old, they come to school with an Uzi. This what got to stop. This is some of the stuff that we have to get a hold of. And I'm going to play Dr. King. Monday, we're playing Dr. King. Maybe something Dr. King will say might register with you to make you get up off that couch, make you try to help somebody, try to help a waver mother. Just go out with Mama Annie Bacon. We had Woodlawn Sisterhood. And Mother Annie Bacon took women in that was pregnant, young girls, when their parents kicked them out. She stopped a many young girls from committing suicide or from killing their babies. I salute Mother Annie Bacon this whole month for her outstanding achievement with the Woodlawn Sisterhood and have shelter. The government won't give no money for no shelter. Government won't give no diapers. Mama Annie and her team reached out and got kids from Woodlawn, Inglewood, all over the city in her sisterhood. I salute her. We asked them to free Larry, free Jeff, free all the political prisoners. And we're going to keep that prayer going because we know they ain't bad as they say, what the government say.
But if not, there was a day when many of the Israelites found themselves in bondage in Babylon. And there was a king of Babylon by the name of Nebuchadnezzar. You read about him a good deal in the book of Daniel, and it stands as an epic that will remain stenciled on the mental sheets of unfolding generations. Nebuchadnezzar was a mighty king. And when he ruled, he ruled. And when he issued an order, he meant business. And Nebuchadnezzar issued an order. He made a golden image and his order was that everybody under the reign of his kingship had to bow before that golden image and worship it. Now, those of you who read the Bible remember that story. One day, Nebuchadnezzar called in the judges and the governors and the sheriffs, and they had a dedicatory service for this golden image. And then he said to them, I'm instructing you to see that everybody bows before this golden image. But there were three young men around there. One's name was Shadrach. The other one's name was Meshach. And the other name was Abednego. And they answered, and I read it from the scripture, and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar,
yeah,
we are not careful to answer thee in this manner. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Now I want you to notice first here that these young men practiced civil disobedience. Civil disobedience is the refusal to abide by an order of the government or of the state or even of the court that your conscience tells you is unjust. Civil disobedience is based on a commitment to conscience. In other words, one who practices civil disobedience is obedient to what he considers a higher law. And then there comes a time when a moral man can obey a law which his conscience tells him is unjust. And I tell you this morning, my friends, that history has moved on. Great moments have often come forth because there were those individuals in every age and every generation who were willing to say, I will be obedient to a higher law. These men were saying, I must be disobedient to a king in order to be obedient to the king. And those people who so often criticize those of us who come to those moments when we must practice civil disobedience never remember that even right here in America, in order to get free from the oppression and the colonialism of the British Empire, our nation practiced civil disobedience. For what represented civil disobedience more than the Boston Tea Party? And never forget that everything that Hitler did in Germany was legal. It was legal to do everything that Hitler did to the Jews. It was a law in Germany that Hitler issued himself that it was wrong and illegal to aid and comfort a Jew in Hitler's Germany. But I tell you, if I had lived in Hitler's Germany with my attitude, I would have openly broken that law.
Make it plain.
I would have practiced civil disobedience. And so it is important to see that there are times when a man-made law is out of harmony with the moral law of the universe. There are times when human laws are out of harmony with eternal and divine laws. And when that happens, you have an obligation to break it. And I'm happy that in breaking it, I have some good company.
Yes.
I have Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I have Jesus and Socrates.
Make it plain.
And I have all of the early Christians who refused to bow. Now the second interesting point is that these men never doubted God and His power as they did what they did. They made it very clear that they knew that God had the power to spare them. They said that to the king. Now we know that the God that we worship is able to deliver us. And that grew out of their experience. They had known God. They had experienced God in nature. They knew God as the creator. And then they had seen God in history.
Yes. Make it plain.
And then they had seen God, I'm sure, in their personal lives.
Yes. Amen.
They never doubted God's power to deliver them. But let me move now to the basic point of the message. No, this morning, if we forget everything I said, I hope you won't forget this. They came to the point after saying our God is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. But if He doesn't deliver us, we still are not going to bow. But if not, do you get that? And these men were saying that our faith is so deep and that we've found something so dear and so precious that nothing can turn us away from it. Our God is able to deliver us, but if not, this simply means, my friends, that the ultimate test of one's faith is his ability to say, but if not. You see, there is what you may call an if faith, and there is a though faith. And the permanent faith, the lasting, the powerful faith, is the though faith. Now the if faith says, if all goes well, if life is hopeful, prosperous, and happy, if I don't have to go to jail, if I don't have to face the agonies and burdens of life, if I'm not ever called bad names because of taking a stand that I feel that I must take, if none of these things happen, then I'll have faith in God. Then I'll be all right. That's the if faith. You know, a lot of people have the if faith. Jacob found himself in that dilemma once, and his faith was contingent on an if. And he said, now, if God will be with me, and if He will keep me in this way that I go, and if God will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, that I come again to my father's house in peace, Then shall the Lord be my God. That's the if faith. Jacob hadn't quite gotten to the essence of religion. There is a though faith, though. And the though faith says, though things go wrong, though evil is temporarily triumphant, though sickness comes and the cross looms, nevertheless, I'm going to believe anyway, and I'm going to have faith anyway. Though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof, the Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. And old Job got to that point, and he had a though faith. He looked out, and everything that he had been taken away from him. And even his wife said to him, now, what you ought to do, Brother Job, is to curse God and die. God has been unkind to you. And you should have let God know a long time ago that you will only follow him if he allowed you to stay rich.
Make it plain.
If he allowed your cattle to stay in place, you ought to curse him and die, Job, because he hadn't treated you right. But Job said, honey, I'm sorry, but my faith is deeper than that. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. My faith is a though faith. And this is the essence of life and religion. The question is whether you have an if faith or whether you have a though faith. You know what this says in substance, that ultimately religion is not a bargaining matter. A lot of people bargain with God. If you just let me avoid pain, God. If you allow me to be happy in all of its dimensions, if you don't allow any suffering to come, if you don't allow frustrating moments to come, then I'll be all right. I'll give you a tenth of my income, and I'll go to church, and I'll have faith in you. Religion is not a bargaining experience. It's not a commercial relationship. And you know, no great experience exists in the bargaining atmosphere. Think of friendship. Think of love. And think of marriage. These things are not based on if.
No, sir.
They are based on though. Mm-hmm. And these great experiences are not based on a bargaining relationship, not an if faith, but a though faith. And I'm coming to my conclusion now.
Lord, yes.
And I want to say to you this morning, my friends, that somewhere along the way, you should discover something that's so dear, so precious to you, that is so eternally worthful that you will never give it up. You ought to discover some principle.
Yes, sir.
You ought to have some great faith that grips you so much that you will never give it up.
Never.
Somehow you go on and say, I know that the God that I worship is able to deliver me. Yes. But if not, I'm going on anyhow. I'm going to stand up for it anyway. What does this mean? It means in the final analysis, you do right not to avoid hell.
Yes.
If you're doing right merely to keep from going to something that traditional theology has called hell, then you are doing right.
Yes.
If you do right merely to go to a condition that theologians have called heaven, you are doing right. If you are doing right to avoid pain and to achieve happiness and pleasure, then you are doing right.
He's got the heart.